Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. There's fresh news on Syria. This is a turn. The Syria story is now moving to the House of Representatives and also to the Senate vote, where it's assured the Foreign Relations Committee reported it out today in a surprisingly partisan 10-7-1. The one vote, that's the new senator from Massachusetts who took John Kerry's chair, and he voted present. No surprise here that he's confused. We all are on Syria. What is not confusing right now is the fresh information that the Air Force, this is according to Wall Street Journal reporting in these last hours, the Air Force is looking at participating in the potential Syrian bombing. We look forward to the details. No longer just the Navy shooting Tomahawks, but the Air Force. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com joins me tonight because the Syria news is so unhappy. We need to move to Asia, where there is something positive to say about trade between China and the United States. And the positive part, Gordon, I'll begin with. Chinese goods are now identified as shoddy. They're shoddy workmanship. It's obvious that their manufacturing base is struggling. They've lost the low end to other competitive countries. They're having trouble with labor practices. In addition, the whole economy is fragile to broken because of credit, the credit bubble that's been created by the Chinese government. Is it understood in China that Americans do not buy and will not buy shoddy manufacturing goods? Do they understand this?
No, they actually view the opposite. They think that they can turn this stuff out and that Americans will buy it because, in fact, we have, and that really is a problem. But there is the image, though, and I think that it's going to become more pervasive as time goes on, that Chinese goods come with a heavy price to them. And that's an important realization that we have not fully absorbed.
We welcome Alan Tonelson, research fellow at the U.S. Business and Industry Council Educational Foundation. Alan, a very good evening to you. I'm certain that there is a large constituency to hear John Batchelor say shoddy Chinese goods. It took me a long time. I was okay with the fact that they were low cost and that it helped America through these difficult years, the Great Recession, and before, during the housing bubble. But now I identify the fact that if this mini pad, iPad that I'm looking at, manufactured no doubt with Chinese hands in one of the parks where they maintain vast resources, if this good turns into a shoddy product, I will no longer buy it, and Apple will be in trouble. I ask you, Alan, straight up, do the Chinese manufacturers, does the Chinese government know that Americans are looking again at buying products from them?
I think that the Chinese government recognizes that in certain areas, their products do have a serious image problem in the U.S., and those areas would include food products and very low-end consumer goods. At the same, and we've also had a great deal of polling in the last year or so, where surveyors go out and they get huge majorities of American shoppers declaring that they're fed up with buying Chinese goods. They want to buy American. It's the patriotic thing to do. It's the right thing to do. They say they identify the Made in America ideal with high quality, great service, etc. And it all sounds so terribly encouraging until you look at the actual data on U.S. trade with China and how much we keep buying. And everything we know about these trade flows tells us that no matter what American consumers tell pollsters, they're still buying Chinese-made goods like gangbusters. And I see no sign of that abating whatever, no matter how much happy talk we see about this in the very credulous U.S. media.
Well, you know, the trade numbers which came out just a few hours ago show a record Chinese trade surplus against the United States. I think that if you look further down the road, it's important here because there's a number of trends that are occurring. So, for instance, you have Apple saying that it will make one of its computers in the United States. And also, there was a study done recently, Alan, that showed that a U.S. cell phone, which is actually starting to be made, has essentially a very little cost disadvantage against China. Now, this comes in the backdrop, though, of course, some Chinese cell phone manufacturers are really starting to do very well, like Xiaomi, which just hired the face of Android, Hugo Barra, which is also, you know, we're going to be seeing Xiaomi phones in the United States. But if the United States can ramp up manufacturing, I think that we do actually have a fairly good future, because just the way trends of manufacturing are going, as John points out, they are helping the United States.
I want to be tough on Alan here. Okay, Alan, this
go
is
ahead.
Your chance. All right, here we go. My opinion of what happened to U.S. manufacturing wasn't just because the Chinese undercut it with cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
There was a falling off of quality and customer care and concern about details in U.S. manufacturing. And I'm being too general, so I'll be specific.
Okay.
General Motors, in the early part of this century, General Motors no longer cared whether the fit of the trunk mattered, whether you could measure on one side a quarter of an inch and measure on the other side the quarter of an inch when you shut the lid, the trunk, the boot. And that, I learned from wise counselors, that was a sign that the General Motors of the 20th century had fallen into disrepair. We saw the results of this in the Great Recession. But I charge the fact that American manufacturers lost this not just because the Chinese undercut them, but because they took their eye off what was important, which is high-quality products delivered trustworthy.
John, I think that that story is mainly true for consumer goods and for automotive. And of course, in consumer goods, most of which are very labor intensive, the United States was simply priced out of that market. And frankly, predatory Chinese trade practices didn't have a great deal to do with that. It's just a low-cost country because it's still a developing country in relatively early stages of modernization. But first of all, we have to remember that the trade problems that American manufacturers have faced, which go back decades, don't start with China, they don't end with China. We have deficits with every major industrial power on this planet. We also have to remember that for all of the problems that the American automotive industry admittedly suffered, lots of which were of its own making, the trade losses that we suffer as a nation year after year, going back many, many years, are not confined to automobiles. They're confined to products like construction equipment and machine tools and specialty chemicals and semiconductors. I don't think there's anybody on earth who knows what they're talking about who thinks that, for example, Intel and Qualcomm make shoddy semiconductors.
All right, fine. You just talked me out of it. I'll stay with General Motors.
I win.
I stay with General Motors, however,
okay.
And I mentioned that. Gordon, Alan has defended himself.
Well, let's talk about General Motors because I just bought a Chevy. And
great.
We just went looking for cars. And, you know, it occurred to me, and this is something that my very wise father-in-law has said, and that is if you buy a Honda Civic or a Toyota Corolla, yes, it is more – it's better from a quality standpoint. But the cost differential now between a Chevy and the foreign competitors is – too wide. And actually the best buy is the Chevy, which is really what we did. And we're just very happy with the car. So, John.
Patriotic Gordon here.
This is not only patriotic Gordon. This is a Gordon who actually has looked at these cars and said, this Chevy is really, really good.
All right, you guys are surrounding me. Alan, stop it. I'm defeated. All right, I'm surrendering. However,
we can't pound it on too much.
Let's go back to Xiaomi, this new phone manufacturer. They're going to flood our zone. That's what they're going to do.
Well, you know, Chinese cell phone manufacturers have already done that. So, for instance, you have a company, Yulong, ZTE. They're in our market. ZTE is the fastest growing cell phone company in the United States. It had 85.7% growth in the first quarter of this year in the U.S.
That ain't bad.
And because of this, have we learned anything about dealing with these trade deficits, especially in electronics? Let me focus just this. I know you'd like to talk about food products, but I will not talk chickens with you. I want to talk electronics. Have American manufacturers learned that quality must be protected, that cheap products will not survive, and also it wrecks your reputation. Even if you sell them, what the heck? You're selling junk, Alan.
Well, I think everything we know about the American automotive sector tells us that the Detroit 3, or maybe they're really the Detroit 2.5 now, have really internalized this lesson, because by every quality study that we have and all of these surveys that come out, J.D. Power and all that, U.S.-made cars, U.S. brand cars, in fact, are getting much better. In fact, we just found out this morning...
My Chevy.
That the big 2.5's U.S. market share,
right, very high,
last month rebounded to 44%.
Okay.
It's getting better.
Then I understand that General Motors has learned that lesson, and I will take it
you
from see? You. I take it from you, Alan, that other people are listening. Alan Tonelson is research fellow at the U.S. Business and Industry Council Educational Foundation. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com.
And a Chevy owner.
And a Chevy owner. You homer, you. And Gordon... The trade deficit climbed again, right?
It certainly did. Alan's right about that.
And I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here with me, and we go right to Seoul, South Korea. Greg Scarlatiu joins us. There is a new report from the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, just posted, I'm told, August 26th, and it identifies new information about what is called the Hidden Gulag. Greg, a very good morning to you. The Hidden Gulag, we've talked of this before. What is fresh here? What have you discovered?
Good evening, John. We have found out that one of the known operational political prison camps in North Korea has six of them, one such facility located near the border with China in Haeryong, North Hamgyong Province, has ceased to exist as a political prison camp. The reason for that is that it is very close to the border with China. There is some Chinese activity, some business activity in the area. There are Chinese tourists in the area. From the viewpoint of the Kim regime, from a PR viewpoint, certainly, it is better for the regime to move these prisoners to other facilities. Also, once a prisoner has escaped from the camp due to the proximity of this facility to the border with China, it would have been easier to find one's way to China and from there on to a third country and to freedom. However, the truly tragic fact about the closure of Camp 22 is that there used to be 30,000 prisoners held there. What we have found out is that from the summer of the last year until early this year, the surviving 3,000 to 8,000 prisoners were relocated to other political prison camps. This means that anywhere between 22,000 and 27,000 prisoners disappeared. We do not know what happened to them. And we have to ensure that the regime does not engage in attempts to erase the evidence or exterminate the witnesses.
A detail here, Greg, before Gordon asks. North Hamgyong Province, is that on the border with China?
That is correct. Yes, it is in northeast North Korea, close to the border with China.
Greg, do we know that, for instance, these 27,000 prisoners were not transferred out, or is this just a sort of a supposition?
It comes from reliable sources. We have spoken with former prisoners. We have spoken with former guards. We have spoken, and this is a new type of source that we have. We have spoken with sources inside North Korea that are contacted by media organizations, human rights organizations, on smuggled Chinese phones. I'm talking about people who have access to these areas and have the ability to visually verify the information that they provide to us. One very important and tragic fact about Camp 22 is that we have had accounts from former guards and former prisoners that had witnessed human experimentation at Camp 22. Prisoners died in gas chambers at Camp 22 several years ago. Suffocating gas was used to kill prisoners in gas chambers.
So we're talking about essentially the deaths of about 27,000 North Koreans in Camp 22, a crime that has just been revealed now, and clearly something that is so horrific that it would make it very difficult, it would seem to me, for us to send a human rights envoy to North Korea, knowing full well what has occurred.
We have not yet been able to verify beyond reasonable doubt that those 22,000 to 27,000 North Korean prisoners were killed. However, we have no evidence that they were transferred to other facilities, and this is certainly work in progress. We continue to analyze satellite imagery, talk to witnesses, try to do our best to determine precisely what happened. Certainly the trip by U.S. Special Envoy for Human Rights, Robert King, was, so we found out from the press, meant to rescue Kenneth Bae, the American who is being held by the North Koreans. The North Koreans have established a pattern of abducting U.S. citizens to use them as bargaining leverage. In 2009, former President Bill Clinton went to North Korea to rescue the two journalists taken by the North Koreans, Eun Ah Lee and Lina Ling. And then the following year, in 2010, former President Carter traveled to North Korea to bring back Ai Hallon Gomez, a native Bostonian who had been taken by the North Koreans. Now, in this particular instance, these deals are not negotiated on the ground. I thought that this was a done deal, basically when the senior official, the former very senior official, travels to a country to bring back a hostage. This deal is non-negotiated in country. By the time that plane takes off, this is a done deal. So the North Koreans engaged in an egregious breach of diplomatic protocol, and this tells us once again that this regime has absolutely zero credibility on the international stage. This regime has breached pretty much each and every agreement that it has entered into.
Greg, just a detail here. Did anything happen that would lead to 27,000 people disappearing? Is this a break in pattern, or is this something you've seen before?
Certainly, with it, we have seen restructuring of the political prison camp system in North Korea. We have seen massive purges before, especially under Kim Il-sung, as Kim Il-sung was establishing his authority as the first leader of North Korea. Massive purges were conducted under Kim Il-sung, under Kim Jong-il. We have evidence that this is happening under Kim Jong-un as well. Those perceived as disloyal to the regime, those perceived as a threat to the regime, those perceived as being wrongdoers, wrong thinkers, having engaged in wrong associations, or possessing wrong knowledge, are purged and taken away in the middle of the night, sent to these political prison camps, oftentimes together with up to three generations of their families. They're subjected to forced labor, induced malnutrition, torture, extraordinarily cruel and severe punishment.
Greg Scarlatti, the camp number 22 located, or was, at North Hamgyong Province. You can see it on your Google Earth maps. The report is just up the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here with me. China, Syria, two states that don't appear on the map or in the news to have anything in common whatsoever. Syria is a client state of Iran. So, again, nothing obvious. Iran's relationship with China is that of a customer that uses North Korea as an R&D, but still nothing that actually connects Syria, or is there? We're joined by Peter Navarro, who's the author of the book Death by China and the producer and guru of the movie Death by China. And Peter, a very good evening to you. Peter's a professor at the University of California at Irvine. the connection between Syria and China, it's not obvious. Syria is a small Middle Eastern state that is entirely under the possession of Tehran. So how does Beijing profit, or how does Beijing see its opportunities in the coming days of American conflict with the Assad regime? Good evening to you.
Good. Okay, here's the chessboard. Basically, China has the same rogue regime deal with Syria as it does with other rogue regimes like the Sudan, Iran, and North Korea. What China does for countries like Syria is use its permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council to veto any possibility of UN action on Syrian human rights violations. Now, what does China get in exchange? Two things, John. They get, first of all, the right to develop Syria's oil market. It's certainly much smaller than other oil markets in the Persian Gulf, but it does produce a significant amount of oil. The second thing China gets is access to Syria's market for their exports. Now, if you look at it on the trading front, you may be surprised to know this, but China is actually Syria's largest trading partner. It's a couple of billion dollars a year, not a big deal for China, but a very, very big deal for Syria. And on the oil front, China is basically the biggest developer of oil in Syria, does joint ventures with the Syrian oil company. So it really has, John, it really has a strong vested interest in the Assad regime. And the other thing it's doing, which brings in the Iranian connection, is as we speak, China is basically helping Syria pump oil, move it through Iran into Iranian tankers, avoiding the sanctions and shipping it over to China. So this is very, very, this is very bad actor stuff. And the idea that our president is going to somehow try to negotiate a deal with the Chinese on this is laughable.
Peter, you know, it's also interesting that the Chinese, through the North Koreans, have been supplying the Assad regime essentially with most of their chemical weapons and also some of their nuclear weapons technology. And also China has, to a lesser extent, directly supplied the Syrians with the precursors for chemical weapons. So essentially we have Beijing involved in some of the world's worst trade with the Assad regime. This is something that it has to stop at some point.
Yeah, Gordon, you make a great point. China basically is the WMD provider to the rogue regimes of the world. Iran would not have a nuclear program now if it weren't for two things. One is the direct provision of the nuclear technology they need from China, and two, indirectly, China's United Nations umbrella in terms of vetoing any UN action. The idea that the chemical weapons now are also part of the Chinese rogue regime network is chilling, and people need to hear exactly what you just said. And it just puzzles me, John and Gordon, why our media, why our politicians don't see this as part of a bigger pattern of what China does. And it's a bad actor, and we really, really need to be strong on this in a way with China.
The Chinese foreign policy, heretofore, we've talked about it before, Gordon, in Africa, where there's a deal of trade going on, Chinese are investing in roads and infrastructure in order to get resources out. But certainly throughout the developing part of the world, the Chinese foreign policy has been presented to me as, I think the word we would use is amoral. They really don't care what you do or how you conduct your business. They're there for old word plunder, new word profit. And they're going to remain as long as it's in their interest, and then they'll bug out. Peter, does that apply to how China treats Syria? Just a client state, there's some money to earn, we can put some nationals in there to work, but they're not involved in Syria's success or failure. They'll stand back when the bombs fall.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. There is something, a principle that China acts on that should be chilling to us. They don't want anybody going into any country in the world and messing around with regime change when it comes to autocratic human rights type violations, because if they look in the mirror themselves, if China looks in the mirror themselves, they're guilty of all of these kinds of things that these other rogue regimes are doing. The second thing is there's kind of like a Gresham's Law going on here where bad states drive out good states. Every time the U.S. and Europe have taken a principled position on human rights against a state and imposed economic sanctions, China amorally just slips in and gains control of the raw materials and resources and markets. And it's just a pattern that's happening all over the country, and Syria is just the latest one that's lighting up the switchboard.
You know, it's not only amoral, but in many instances, it is immoral. This is a foreign policy that Beijing conducts, which, as Peter talked about, drives out good foreign policies around the world. And the Chinese do it for the worst possible reasons. Not only do they want to promote authoritarianism, but they also want to promote the dissemination of weapons of mass destruction because they know that they'll be used against the West. This is a policy of basically using the North Koreas and the Pakistans to distribute the world's most destructive weaponry.
I want to speculate a little bit because we've established China as a bad actor behind bad actors. However, Peter, your opinion now, Professor. The intention of the Obama administration is to use Tomahawks, that's cruise missiles at long range. Perhaps the Air Force will get involved in using firing platforms from 40,000, 20,000 feet, but I don't expect F-18 strikes over Damascus soon enough. They do have a moderate integrated air defense there, and that would risk casualties. In any event, the bombs are likely to fall in the next 2 weeks. Let's be hypothetical here. Your opinion, Peter, does that benefit China? Is this China smiling, saying, go ahead, bomb away, we'll profit?
I think China, it gets to take kind of the moral high ground here, which to me is high irony. I mean, here you have another case of the United States unilaterally firing missiles at foreign territory. And it's like, oh, here they go again. First there was Afghanistan and Iraq, and now it's Syria. And they're able to kind of group these things together, and there's no... The whole idea of a cause or a reason kind of gets lost in the whole shuffle. To me, the Obama administration's idea of just throwing cruise missiles at a few places in Syria is really misplaced unless they were able to do one thing, and that would be to wipe out the Syrian Air Force. If they could do that, then that would be productive. Otherwise, this is just weakening our position, playing into China's hands, and not really helping anything that's going on in Syria.
Gordon, I'd like you to speculate a little bit, looking into the future. How does China use the Tomahawks over Syria to its advantage in Asia?
Well, what it's going to do, I think, is a couple of things. First of all, it's going to criticize the United States. You know, once it's actually neutered the UN, and so therefore sort of eliminated the non-forceful solutions, it then gets to blame the United States and France and the others for using force. The other thing that it will do is, while the United States is involved in Syria and in the Middle East, it's going to be engaged in mischief against the Japanese, the Filipinos, maybe against India. So really, while our attention is being diverted to Syria, it is going to make gains in doing some pretty destructive things along its periphery.
Japan, right now, they've got a government that has said that it's willing to confront the Chinese in the East China Sea. When the U.S. fires cruise missiles into Syria, does Japan lose us as an ally, as a shoulder-to-shoulder against the Chinese aggression?
Well, they won't lose us, but, you know, clearly the Japanese realize that American military assets are going to be shifted to the Mediterranean, which means that they won't be available in the East China Sea to counter Chinese aggression against the Senkakus. And this really is going to be the same issue, because we won't be in the South China Sea protecting Philippine shoals again from Chinese aggression.
Peter, what I'm hearing is that everything about the pending Obama administration policy, if it's going to talk about it in terms of responsibility to protect or worrying about enforcing the chemical weapons treaty, by the way, hasn't been much enforced for the last 40 years. But if they're going to do that, 20 years since the 90s, if they're going to do that, is China in a position to use moral equivalency here and to pretty much wipe out any of the arguments that the United States can use with our allies in Asia when China's aggressive towards them?
Yeah, it basically gives them license to shoot cruise missiles at Taiwan or Japan or whoever else they want on the basis of some kind of threat to their sovereignty. And that's the scary part here. We need to do that pivot to Asia, and we need to execute that correctly, because I think that's where the balance of power in the world is going to be determined in the future. And Gordon's absolutely right. What China historically has done is to use crises like this to engage in mischief below the radar in other places. So this is a real failure of foreign policy by our country, and our Secretary of State is really, he uses big words, but he's in over his head. And our President really, it's going on, close to 6 years now, he really hasn't parsed the Chinese mentality and figured out that they're not the good guys.
Peter Navarro is a professor at the University of California at Irvine. He is the author of Death by China and the producer of the documentary Death by China. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here with me, and we're off to Hong Kong. Joseph Sternberg, the business editor of the editorial page of the Asia Wall Street Journal, joins. A new piece filed by his colleagues Anil Gupta and Haiyan Wang, just up now, about investing in Asia. The recommendation here is to stay the course, that is, to find things to buy, to find investments that are attractive. During a period, you'd have to say that Asia's in a, well, let's put it, be diplomatic here. What the heck? Diplomacy failed in Syria, so it can work here in Asia. Turmoil. We'll call it turmoil. And there's a pattern here that Mr. Gupta and his colleague identify, which is that when things fall apart in Asia, all of a sudden the regimes get interested in reform. Okay, there's the good news. Suddenly now they're available to it. They clean up their act. Does this sound like China or not, Gordon? They clean up their act. The tax revenues rise. Foreign capital flows in. Things return to stability. And suddenly they forget about reforms and they're back to business as usual. Joseph, a very good morning to you. This sounds like human behavior, doesn't it? You know, you clean up your room and then it gets messy again and you don't do anything until mom yells at you. Is that Asia? Good morning, Joe.
That's one way of looking at what's happening here. Basically, global investors are the yelling mom, and there are Asian governments who do need to start cleaning up their bedrooms again in terms of economic reform.
But, Joe, you know, there's a big difference between now and the Asian financial crisis in 1997. Because this piece that you ran basically makes the point, well, you know, there's blood in the streets. You should go out and invest in Asia because it's probably not as bad as you think. But the difference between now and the last time this happened in Asia was that in 1997, 1998, the Asian financial crisis, essentially United States and Europe pulled the region out of its problems by basically buying everything that Asians could bake. Now we have a situation where maybe the rest of the world isn't going to do that. Maybe the crises this time are actually bigger because they're occurring around the world at the same time. And then you add in the geopolitical risk, you know, people talking about World War III starting over Syria. Now, that might be a little bit overdone, but maybe it's not. So you really do have a situation right now where risk may not be as fully appreciated as these authors think. What do you think?
I think that there's something to that argument, although I would add a couple caveats to that. I mean, of course, the big picture here is that what's afflicting Asia over the past few months is that as there's been this talk of tapering on quantitative easing in the U.S., interest rates of return in America are starting to increase again. So a lot of capital that had come to Asia, was basically pushing itself out further a little bit on the risk curve in search of higher returns, is now being able to return to the U.S. I think in that sense, there is a greater appreciation of the risks of investing in Asia. But, you know, I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the reason that this is happening at all is because there are signs that the U.S. economy is starting to pick up, even if it won't be importing Asian goods the way it did in the 90s. And other changes that Asian economies themselves have had a lot of opportunities to, you know, a lot of time to grow since then. So I think you do have somewhat more of a domestic market out here than you did back in the 90s, and that provides some opportunities to fuel growth. Will it replace the U.S. and Europe? No, they aren't at that level of development yet. But I don't think that you should be unremittingly gloomy about the prospects for Asia right now.
There's an historical frame for the piece that Joseph is publishing by Mr. Gupta and Ms. Wang. Mr. Gupta is a professor of strategy and globalization at the University of Maryland. Ms. Wang is the managing partner at the China India Institute. Together, they are the authors of Getting China and India Right. They point to the example of General Electric buying in Thailand, GE Capital, buying in Thailand during the financial crisis of 1997. Now, that's an investor I can understand, Joseph. As opposed to buying into a stock market, you're looking to buy companies that are in distress because of currency collapses or poor governance that does not necessarily have to last. So would that be a benefit in Asia right now for companies to go shopping for subsidiaries or to expand their asset base?
Yeah, I think that that is definitely, I mean, even before this recent turmoil, that was the kind of investment that Asia really needs a lot of. And we need to distinguish between different kinds of investors right now. I mean, the ones who have been fleeing over the past couple months are basically portfolio investors, the ones who are investing in bonds or stocks or other financial assets. But, you know, a company like a GE or any of the others who are actually companies that make things, you know, that kind of direct investor, they might find more opportunities here. You know, if you have stock markets coming down, you know, that might make some companies easier acquisition targets than they used to be out here. And, you know, perhaps that creates an opening for that sort of longer term, you could call it a reforming investment to come in, shake up corporate governance, lead to improvement that way.
Joe, if you look at the three big economies in the region, Japan, China, and India, how do you parse them out?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, part of the problem is that they're all so different and the problems facing them are very different. I mean, I think that I'm perhaps more optimistic about Japan than I am about the other two, simply because you have the Abenomics agenda going on there from Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And even though I'm really skeptical that that is going to produce a lot of changes, even if he can just do one or two things, like the joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, that would be very good for the Japanese economy over the longer term. You know, in India, the problem is the lack of political will for reform. Over the past few years, investors piled in, hoping that there would eventually be reforms that would boost the economy. Those reforms never came. Now investors are losing patience. And you know, in China, we've discussed a lot of the political problems that are going to hinder further reform there, and I think many of those problems might be insurmountable for now.
Joseph, we take advantage of you at a listening post in Hong Kong with just a moment here left. Syria, is it dominating the conversation? Is it seen as a threat to the markets in the short term?
I'm not sure investors are focusing so much on the Syria story right now, but I think that what does make a difference is what it says about U.S. credibility and our ability to keep our word on military or strategic matters, which will really be of interest to a lot of our allies or potential allies on something like the South China Sea dispute, you know, where people are going to draw some worrying conclusions about whether the Obama administration will really stand by its word when push comes to shove.
And therefore, the Syria, the bombs fall, that satisfies the doubters or it puzzles them?
Well, I think in some respects the damage is already done with all of this to-ing and fro-ing about whether it really was a red line or wasn't a red line. I mean, Asians will look at that and wonder, well, gosh, if the U.S. says to China it's a red line if you do this, that, or the other thing in the South China Sea, and then China does it anyway, is America still going to think it's a red line? So I think that this, you know, there's already a credibility problem.
General war in Asia, Joseph. general war in Asia. Think about it.
Joseph Sternberg of the Asia Wall Street Journal is the editorial page. Business editor Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. The United States draws a line in the sand, and the tide comes in. I'm John Batchelor.